Well, again, thank you for being here. We have, of course, been looking at the book of 2 Samuel the last few weeks and discussing the reign of King David. And so as we have now gotten to the end of this writing, we are now at the end of his reign, and we're coming upon the transition from David to Solomon. In our study last week, we discussed the death of Absalom, how he was killed in battle, and we ended discussing the return of David to Jerusalem. Now, as I mentioned last week, we can read that simple statements of Absalom dying, David returning, but there's a lot of things that go into that. As we mentioned last week, we were in the midst of a broken people. And so as a part of that, in a way to try to heal the nation, David begins to pardon his enemies. We looked at that last week. There are a couple important pardons that he offers. Now, in tonight's study, we'll continue on with that. Again, I'm sorry for the small print. I know that's really small. But we'll begin by looking at David repaying a debt that was where someone had shown him great kindness as he fled Jerusalem. We'll look at the division in the nation and how that kind of, you can see that, and how this may have some longer lasting effects as we move forward. Another rebellion arises, another one much shorter lived, but the people again, a group tries to rebel. And then David begins to do some things as he ends his gets near the end of his reign. One thing, he avenges the Gibeonites from the failure of King Saul, and how King Saul had promised them protection and had not lived up to that. War will break out between the Israelites and the Philistines. We're just and that'll of course cause a little bit of issue, but they'll be able to get through that. David delivers a song of deliverance, or puts forward a song of deliverance. And then as we get to the end of the book, David will give his last words. And unfortunately, near the very end, he'll take an ill-advised census of the people, which will again get him in trouble with God. And so I know it's a lot there. A lot of those are going to be very brief discussions, maybe, as we move forward. So let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 19 as we look at this section on David repaying a debt. If you go to 2 Samuel chapter 19, verse 31, now David again is returning to Jerusalem. And as he does, you remember we stated last week, he's now on the other side of the Jordan from Jerusalem. Now, the River Jordan is significant because it creates a border between the Israelite nation and the rest of the world, right? It's one of its borders. And so as David prepares to go across the Jordan to go back to Jerusalem, he's got some things he's dealing with to begin this rebuilding process. One of those who had shown him great kindness in his fleeing was a man named Barzillai. Barzillai had fed David and his men when they were fleeing, when they were hungry, when he was desperate to get away from Jerusalem. He had shown him a lot of kindness. And so David is attempting to repay that. The text tells us in verse 31, Barzillai, the Gileadite, had come down from Roglam, and he went on with the king to the Jordan to escort him over the Jordan. Barzillai was a very aged man, 80 years old. He had provided the king with food while he stayed at Mahanaim, for he was a very wealthy man. And so he's shown him this great kindness. Verse 33, as you continue on, David says to him, "Come over with me, and I will provide for you with me in Jerusalem." So he's offering to bring him into his house, right, to to repay in a small way the debt that was given to him. Well, the text notes that he's an older man. Well, he doesn't want to do this. You notice what he says, verse 34 says, "How many years have I still to live that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem?" In essence, Barzelli doesn't really want to leave his homeland. He doesn't want to go to Jerusalem. He would rather stay at home and to die there. He says in verse 37 that he says to David, "Please let your servant return that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and my mother. But here is your servant Chimham. Let him go over with my lord the king and do for him whatever seems good to you." And so he says, "I don't want to do this, but I have someone in my house that I would like to send with you." And of course, David says okay to this. He essentially says in verse 38, "Chimham shall go over with me, and I will do whatever seems good to you. And all that you desire for me, I will do for you." Then all the people went over the Jordan, and the king went over. And the king kissed Barzelli and blessed him, and he returned to his own home. And so David repays his debt, and he brings in Chimham into his house to be a part of his household to repay that debt. Now, as you get to the end of chapter 19, I want you to notice something here, and I think there's some deeper implications for what's said here. Let's read it, and then I want to talk about it for just a second. So go down to verse 40. Notice what the text says. So he's returning to Jerusalem. Now, as I mentioned before, just to set the context, you remember it was the elders of Jerusalem who had chosen, or the elders of the Israelite people, who had chosen Absalom over David. That's significant, right? Those are things that you just don't heal overnight. There's some embarrassment. There may be some hurt feelings. There may be some, "I don't really know how this works." And so verse 40, the text tells us the king went on to Gilgal, and Chimham went on with him. And it says, "All the people of Judah and also half the people of Israel brought the king on his way." So Judah now is with David. Remember he said earlier in the text, we looked at this last week, David basically asked, "How long will you wait to call me home?" And he's talking to the people of Judah. He says, "You're my tribe. You're my people. You're my blood. Why haven't you called me home?" Well, they, of course, do eventually. And now they're coming with him. Verse 41, "Then all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, 'Why have our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household over the Jordan and all David's men with him?'" So what's going on here? What are they upset about? Did you catch that? All right, we'll read some more and then I'll ask it again. So let's go on just a little bit more. Verse 42, "All the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, 'Because the king is our close relative, why then are you angry over this matter? Have we eaten at all at the king's expense, or has he given us any gift?' And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah, 'We have 10 shares in the king, and in David also we have more than you. Why then did you despise us? Were we not the first to speak of bringing the king, of bringing back our king?'" All right, before I read the last phrase there, you see what's going on here? What are they upset about? So I'm going to ask the question. Y'all going to respond, right? What are they upset about? Who's upset first? Let me ask that. That's a more basic question. Who are the two groups arguing here? Okay, the men of Judah and the men of Israel. What's significant about that? Now, we live a long time after. We can look back in the text of Scripture, and we can know, we can see in the rearview mirror a little bit more than they could see because they're living in the time. But what do we know happens later on with Rehoboam and Jeroboam?
The whole kingdom splits up.
And how does it split?
10 tribes on one side, 2 on the other.
What do you call the 10?
Israel.
What do you call the 2?
Judah.
Do you notice something going on here? Kind of what's going on in our country, by the way.
So they're drawing up sides already.
There's division. There's identity. The identity isn't... Now, there was always identity. Identity in the nation of Israel. There was always identity in regard to your tribe and your family. But now you're seeing something different. It's not as a nation, as a whole, but you're beginning to see a fracture beginning to develop between I'm of the 10 tribes of Israel, or I'm of the 10 tribes of Judah. Division beginning to show its face in the nation. Now, is division, is this something we should be concerned about? What was Abraham Lincoln, in quoting from Holy Scripture, what did he say in quoting the New Testament? A house what? A house divided against itself shall not stand. So, as far back as this period, division has already begun in the house of Israel. You're already seeing people dividing themselves up. And notice what the men of Israel said to David, or said to the men of Judah, sorry. Well, we're the 10 tribes. We've got more stake in David than you do. Look, we're 10, you're 2. This is, I think, an important moment in the nation of Israel. You're already starting to see different identifications. Even in our country, I don't want to get into a political discussion, but it used to be we were all Americans. Now, there were always little fractures here and there, but the majority of people saw themselves as Americans. You don't hear that as much anymore. It's, I'm of this political persuasion, I'm of this one. And you're starting to see frictions. And some of these frictions are pretty intense, aren't they? And so you start to see those sparks. Now we're just one king away from a divided kingdom. Solomon, and then here comes Rehoboam, whom God takes away 10 of the tribes from, and then eventually Jeroboam. So we'll talk more about that as it comes. But I just want to note that as early as this period, you're already beginning to see division. All right. Any questions about that? All right. So David gets back. It's all a celebration. Everything's great, right? No. He doesn't really come home to peace. David, and I made this analogy last week, and I think it's true. Now, you think about after the Civil War in our own country, Abraham Lincoln, some of his most trying time came after the Civil War. Now, he didn't live very long after, but you go back and read some of the things he wrote. What was he having to deal with in our country? Take two people who actually just fought a war against one another and put them back together. Well, here, you've got David coming home to a very similar situation. You just had two groups of people fighting one another. And he's got to try to put that back together. That's not easy. And so he comes back, and chapter 20 tells us, now there happened to be a worthless man whose name was Sheba. Now, what do we know about Sheba? He was the son of Bechri, a Benjaminite. So we don't know a whole lot about him. We just know he's a worthless man. That's the way the writer here describes him. He's a worthless man, and what does he do? Well, he blew the trumpet and said, "We have no portion in David, and we have no inheritance in the son of Jesse." What's he doing? We just talked about division. What's he doing? He's stirring the pot and playing on the division that's already there. And so the text goes on to say, "Every man to his tents, O Israel." So all the men of Israel withdrew from David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah followed their king steadfastly from Jordan to Jerusalem. So David has a real issue right now. He just got over, you know, the Absalom trial, and he's not even really over that yet, but he's coming home at least, and he's trying to put it back together. And what happens? He doesn't even get back to Jerusalem, and here is this guy, this worthless guy who's trying to take advantage of the situation, and he tries to pull the men of Israel away. Verse number 3, David came to his house in Jerusalem, and the king took So, this kind of breaks from the context of what we're just reading, so I'm trying to think of. So, we'll go ahead and deal with this real quick. So, you remember when Absalom, what was the advice that he was given in regard to David's concubines have been left back? Well, his advice was to take care of the house in Jerusalem, was to lie with them. And to lie with them publicly. Well, David's also got that situation to deal with. Not trying to justify anybody's actions, just telling you what's there. What does he do when he gets back with those women? The text tells us he took the 10 concubines whom he had left to care for the house and put them in a house under guard and provided for them, but did not go into them, so they were shut up until the day of their death as living as if in widowhood. And so you've got him coming back. He's got this other situation to deal with. And so he decides, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to take these 10 concubines that Absalom lied with. I'm going to put them in a house and put them away from me. And so that's how he deals with that. I don't know, is it right, wrong? They do the right thing? There's a lot here about the situation you'd have to really go through and analyze. Number one, was it right for David to have concubines? The answer would be no, right? Number one. Number two, is he treating them properly? Again, I don't know the best answer for this situation. Now, when he at least took care of them, he provided for them. Is it the right thing to do? I think it's a difficult question to answer fully. There's definitely a lot here that were set in motion long ago that shouldn't have been there in the first place. So he does that. Verse 4, the text goes on to say that the king then said to Amasa. Now, Amasa is who? Who is this guy? This was Absalom's commander, right? He was the commander of Absalom's armies. Now, David, before he came back to Jerusalem, sent a note to him and said what? We talked about it last week. He said, "I'm going to put you in place of my men now instead of Joab." So he had actually given him the place of Joab. So that's what they're coming back to. So he's been put in place. Just to note the context as we move forward here. He said, call the men of Judah together to me within 3 days and be here yourself. So Amasa went to summon Judah, but he delayed beyond the set time that had been appointed for him. All right, so David's coming back. He summons the men, but where is Amasa? Well, he's not here. So Abishai, which is Joab's brother, he says, now Sheba the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servant and pursue him, lest he get himself to fortified cities and escape from us. So you remember when Absalom was seeking advice, the advice that he listened to was, wait, get all your men together, then go to battle. This is different here. Abishai says to David, don't wait, go. You need to overtake them before they get into a fortified city and you have trouble getting them out. So David does David tells Abishai to do that. Verse 6. And then later in verse 9, so Joab then catches up to Amasa. Remember, Amasa was the one who was set to take Joab's place. And he says, is it well with you, my brother? And Joab took Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. But Amasa did not absorb, what's Joab doing? The sword that was in Joab's hand. And so Joab struck him with it in the stomach and spilled his entrails to the ground without striking a second blow. And he died. Tough way to go out. So he must have had a pretty good beard on him. He grabs him by it and just drives the sword into it. And so now Amasa's dead. He's left to lie there on the street. So they pursued Sheba. He passed through all the tribes of Israel to Abel Bethmaachah, and all the Bichrites assembled and followed him in. And all the men who were with Joab came and besieged him in Abel of Bethmaachah. And they cast a mount against the city, and it stood against the rampart. And they were battering the wall to throw it down. So David already knew it's bad if he gets into a city and gets fortified. How are we going to get him out? So now he's in that situation. So they go in. You do what you do when you're trying to siege a city. He's there before the gates. They're battering it, just as he said. And kind of an interesting interaction. A woman from the city, she's like, what's going on here? So she goes, she sticks her head over the wall, and she begins to have a conversation here with Joab. She says in verse 16, listen, tell Joab, come here that I may speak to you. All right, so they get Joab. Joab in verse 20 comes, and he says, she asked basically the question there, and I don't have a, but what are you doing? Why are you coming against us? Joab says to her in verse 20, far be it from me, far be it, that I should swallow up or destroy. That is not true. But a man of the hill country of Ephraim, called Sheba, the son of Bichri, has lifted up his hand against King David. Give him up alone, and I will withdraw from the city. And the woman said to Joab, behold, his head shall be thrown to you over the wall. And so he says, you give him up, we're done, we'll leave. She says, okay. And so verse 22, she went to all the people in her wisdom. They cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. So he blew the trumpet and dispersed from the city every man to his home, and Joab returned to Jerusalem to the king. So he quells this rebellion. She goes in, she says, we need to give him the head, whatever she says to him. They say, hey, that sounds like a great idea. Let's cut his head off and throw it over. So this was a very short-lived rebellion. Now, what's the difference between this guy and Absalom? Why was Absalom more successful than this guy? He what?
Endeared the people.
That's the big difference here. You remember Absalom worked on this for a while. It was a long thing. The text tells us earlier that he stole the hearts of Israel. He had gained their true allegiance. Now, what do we know from this very text? That's not the case with Sheba. He had not done that. If they're willing to cut his head off and throw it over the wall that quickly, that lets you know that the force of his rebellion was just not as strong, because the men didn't love him the way they loved Absalom. So David's able to quell that rebellion and move forward. Any questions about anything so far? I'm moving through this kind of quickly. I'll even some of this even be quicker, but any questions about anything so far? I got to get y'all talking with me. We got to start interacting. So maybe I need to ask better questions. It's usually the teacher's fault. So let's move forward. So now David is now king again. Verse 1 of chapter 21 lets us know that there was a famine in the land. So, man, this is not a good way to start off. This is not good. He's just gotten back. He had to quell one rebellion. He got that taken care of. And then what happens? Well, now you've got a famine. Now, you want to get people against you, start affecting their checkbook or their stomach, right? People will turn against you quickly. And now there's this famine. Not David's fault, but it is. Notice how long. 3 years. 3 years. That's a long time. Now, if this situation in Ukraine doesn't, I mean, it's going to affect us. I hope it doesn't last 3 years. I mean, do we realize that a third is what I heard, of the world's wheat comes from that area? That's going to affect our bread and those kind of things, isn't it? That's going to have an effect on us. It's going to affect the how much we have and the cost of it. So get ready to pay some gasoline prices for bread, for a loaf of bread, right? Maybe we'll all get on that no-carb diet, right? Might be good for all of us, I guess. I love bread. That'd be hard. But here's a famine for 3 years. And so David sought the face of the Lord, and the Lord said, I wonder about this. Now, I don't know, I don't want to speak too much here about when he did it, but did he do it after 3 years? Did he finally ask this question? If he did, that seems a little kind of crazy to me. I would have thought to go to God a lot earlier. Maybe God hadn't answered him yet, but God does give him an answer here. He says, there is blood guilt on Saul, on the house, and on his house, because he put the Gibeonites to death. They had been promised protection, and Saul had killed them. And why did God choose this moment to do this? I don't know. But God decides now is the time. Now, God's much smarter than me and knows better how things should play out. But God had decided now was the time that Israel needed to wake up to what they had done to the Gibeonites. And so God says there's a blood guilt on Saul and on his house. Now, if you're David, you might be thinking, God, that was Saul. We dealt with Saul, right? Why are you doing this to me? I'm already having so much trouble. And for 3 years, right? What does that teach us about sin? What does it teach us about sin? about the repercussions of sin. It lasts beyond the immediate moment. It affects more than the sinner. And the sinner has been long since gone. And yet they're still dealing with this. And so for 3 years, I can imagine that. I mean, we've had moments like that in the not too distant past, but we of course, as a very blessed society, those are things that we've not had to really deal with. So in some ways, it's kind of hard to relate to when you haven't experienced it. But I imagine how tough it is. And there are people in our world who can. But for 3 years. And so God says there's this blood guilt. Verse number 2, if you go on, he says, so the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the people of Israel. What were they not? Jews, right? They're not Israelites. But of the remnant of the Amorites. Although the people of Israel had sworn, what? To spare them. So that was the promise when they came into the land. This goes all the way back to Joshua. This was a promise that had been given to the Gibeonites. Now you remember, the Gibeonites were really smart about that. They saw what Israel was doing to all these other nations, and so they got on the Israelites' good side, and they made a deal with Joshua, and so they had this pact. Well, the text goes on to say, well, Saul didn't live up to that, did he? Although the people of Israel had sworn to spare them, Saul had sought to strike them down in his zeal for the people of Israel and Judah. Why did Saul do it? What was he trying to do? Do you remember what he was trying to do in that moment? He wanted to seek glory for himself. And he thought the way to do that was to attack the Gibeonites. Well, in doing that, he had overlooked the promise of God, the pact that had been made long ago. And so that wasn't right. And so God says, you owe them a blood guilt. And so David brings them, they inform him of this. And so David then says, sometimes solutions to problems aren't clean. We'll talk about that in just a minute, but just remember that. Sometimes solutions aren't easy. David said to the Gibeonites, what shall I do for you? And how shall I make atonement that you may bless the heritage of the Lord? So basically he's asking, how can we make this better? Now I wonder if the Gibeonites even realize, I mean, I'm sure they knew Israel hadn't lived up to their bargain, but they're there. This is a big ask, right? Because this is, you know, how do you overcome something like that? So they say to the king in verse 5, the man who consumed us and planned to destroy us so that we should have no place in all the territory of Israel. So I didn't include this in verse 4, but basically they say to him, we're not after to destroy you, right, or your people. But notice who they focus on. They focus on King Saul. Now, King Saul is long gone, so how do you deal with that? So verse 6, let seven of his sons be given to us so that we may hang them before the Lord at Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord. And the king said, I will give them. That's what I'm saying. Sometimes there's not easy solutions to this. Now, we don't know if these seven men were involved in what happened with Saul. Maybe they all were. I don't know one way or the other, and I don't want to speak to that. But they said, we want seven sons. Now, seven is a significant number in Scripture. What does seven denote in Scripture? Completeness, a finished task. You know, God created the world in 6 days, and on the seventh he rested. The task had been completed, so he rested. And so they say they want seven sons. Now, David says, okay, we'll do that. Verse 7, though, the text lets us know, but the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Saul's son, Jonathan, because of the oath of the Lord that was between them, between David and Jonathan and the son of Saul. So you have, what's interesting here to me is you've got several promises or oaths all kind of coming at one another, and you've got to figure out which oath is more important than the other. And so David, in his wisdom, said, I have this greater oath to Jonathan and to Mephibosheth. I will spare him. He's not going to be a part of the seven that I'm going to offer to the Gibeonites. Verse 9, and he gave them into, talking about, so he goes on, verse 8, list of seven sons. And he gave them, verse 9, into the hand of the Gibeonites. They hanged them on the mountain before the Lord. Notice that. Hanged them on the mountain before the Lord. And the seven of them perished all perished together. They were put to death in the first days of the harvest. Notice again, significance here. They were hung when? During the first days of the harvest. What had they just endured for 3 years? Famine. They did it in the presence of whom? The Lord. What had God said to David? You have a blood guilt. And so that blood guilt is appeased here in the harvest, at the harvest time. So some significant kind of things going on here. Questions about that? Okay. Somebody wants to talk about that. It's kind of tough, isn't it? And it's like, you know, that's one of those, they're not always easy answers. Yes, ma'am.
Well, that whole scenario, that wasn't particularly David's sin. You know, that was mm-hmm. Saul's sin. But I think it's an interesting concept that David asked the Gibeonites what he needed to do to atone. You know, mm-hmm. A lot of times in today's world, when we're the one who sins against somebody else or offends somebody else, however you want to say it, we do what we feel is right or justified. And that was a pretty significant thing that they requested. That wasn't something small and insignificant. And I just find it interesting, the whole concept that David asked them. And their request was kind of huge. And David met their request.
Yeah, because that was... Yeah, so you're exactly right. I mean, he was, or the nation was the one under the blood guilt. And so it would be them. They would have to set the parameter of what would appease that guilt. And sometimes, you know, the only way to repay it is with a significant execution here. And you have seven executions in this moment. Tough stuff. Yes, sir.
So David asked more like a servant than he did a king dictating when he asked this.
He did, I'm sorry, say it one more time.
More in a servant mode, asking instead of a dictator or a king.
And because he really is at their service in that moment, isn't he? Good stuff. All right, so can I just quickly mention this last thing here, just real quick. So in verses 12 through 14, David, interestingly enough, after this is over, he goes and gets the bones of Saul, Jonathan, who had been stolen earlier. And he brings him, verse 13, and they're gathered together, even the ones who had been hanged. He gathered them with the bones of Jonathan and Saul. And they buried them, verse 14, in the land of Benjamin, in Zelah, in the tomb of Kish, his father. So it is fascinating, just to kind of wrap this up, there's kind of a significant moment that Saul is finally laid to rest to have some portion of peace after the blood guilt is paid. He's finally brought to his father's tomb. I know it's just bones. I know it's just physical representation. But it is interesting that that whole Saul episode in the nation of Israel is finally given resolution after this is over. And he's finally buried with his father, with his family. All right. Thank you all. Next week, we'll go on to 20, cover the rest of 21, the rest of the 2 Samuel. Thank you. We'll be dismissed and begin our devotional period in just a few minutes.